at WPFW.org.
The talk show Africa Now airs Wednesdays at 1 p.m. It's a modern view on historical issues concerning the entire African world, addressing how African people are participating in globalization, ways in which the rest of the world continues to exploit African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available on iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
The Democratic Party convention recently held in Chicago, Illinois, was applauded for its form, but what about its substance? A political analyst covering the convention will provide an insider's perspective. Breaking news. Attorneys defending Moses African Cemetery have filed another lawsuit against desecration. Stay tuned for an incredible program. Good morning and welcome to What's at Stake. I'm your host, Dr. Marsha Coleman Adebayo, and I'm with you the fourth Wednesday of each month. Who can forget the incredible speeches by Michelle and former President Barack Obama, or the nomination of presidential candidate Kamala Harris and Tim Walz for vice president? The Democrats took care to highlight various political and economic issues, but through the choreography and music, which issues were drowned out and why? We will explore this issue with our first guest. Dr. Wilmer Leon is a political scientist whose primary areas of expertise encompass Black politics, American government, and public policy. Dr. Leon is a nationally syndicated columnist and host of Sirius XM Satellite Radio's Inside the Issues with Wilmer Leon. He is a contributor to Black Agenda Report and other publications. Dr. Leon, welcome to What's at Stake.
Oh, thank you so much for the invitation. I greatly, greatly appreciate it.
Thank you. Would you mind if I call you Wilmer?
Please do. Been Wilmer a lot longer than Dr. Leon.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. The American public witnessed for nearly 1 week the National Democratic Convention. Most of us watched this program from the comfort of our homes, but you had a front row seat at the convention. First of all, could you tell our listeners, were you there as a journalist? Were you there as a political analyst? Were you there as a delegate? I mean, what role did you attend at the convention?
Well, I was there as a political analyst. I never refer to myself as a journalist because I don't have a degree in journalism. I'm a political scientist with radio shows and podcasts, and I do international analysis, so I never want to insult a journalist. I was there as a political analyst with politicsincolor.com. And so I was there to do interviews, to observe the event. And also, I went to the RNCC as well. So, I'm able to do a little compare and contrast between the two. But I was there at more, I would say, in the role of a political analyst.
Okay, interesting. So could you provide background as to what it was like to actually attend the convention? I mean, what we could see was obviously beautifully choreographed and staged, but you were there. Have you been able to see any of the television coverage of the convention?
Yes, I have.
Can you compare and contrast what you actually saw compared to what was actually presented on television?
Well, I was really surprised at the level of energy that was in the space, because just, 3 weeks ago, as folks were anticipating a Joe Biden convention, the sense of enthusiasm was incredibly, incredibly depressed. But once Vice President Harris stepped in, as President Biden stepped out, the level of enthusiasm increased dramatically. And I was really shocked at how smooth of a transition they were able to make. You would have had no idea when you stepped in the United Center that there had even been a glitch in the process. These folks that are there, I guess the best analogy I would use is they now believe that the light at the end of the tunnel is the end of the tunnel, not an oncoming train.
I love that analogy. And did you have any sense that perhaps there was, you know, that other that the people who are in charge of these sorts of things had a preview of this happening long before they sort of signaled it to the American public? Or do you really think it was that spontaneous and that smooth, a transition from, you know, from the president to the vice president?
I'd have to say, I think there was a combination of the two. So President Biden stepped out, I think it was on a Sunday. Mm-hmm. I would venture to guess that they knew that this was coming earlier in the week. It'd be hard for me to see that they had much more notice than that. But again, I could be wrong on that one since I'm not in the room and have no great insight. But it did seem as though President Biden was hell bent on staying in the race until the very end. And your question about the media coverage, I think the media coverage was fairly accurate in terms of reflecting what was taking place inside the perimeter, the security perimeter, and the United Center. They did not reflect the protests that were going on outside the perimeter, and I don't think that they accurately reflected the protests that was able to take place by the uncommitted delegates outside the door of the United Center within the perimeter. But short of the issue regarding genocide in Palestine, I think the coverage was fairly accurate.
You think it was accurate?
Yes.
And so just for our listeners and for myself as well, you're talking about perimeters and inside and outside of perimeters. You want to give our listeners an idea of what that means?
They set up, I'll say, about a 3-block, maybe 4-block radius of a security perimeter. The Secret Service, along with the Chicago PD and other security entities, they set up a perimeter of, I'd say, about 4 blocks around the United Center. So without credentials, you could not get inside of that perimeter. That was not going to happen. Some folks tried to breach the perimeter, I think it was Monday, and they were quickly repelled, and there were no other breaches of that perimeter. So once you got inside that perimeter, once you went through security, then it was a pristine, calm environment. But there were protests outside that perimeter that were primarily supporting the issue of pro-Palestinian anti-genocide in Gaza.
And how large would you estimate those protests were?
That one is a little hard to describe because what the Chicago PD was very adept at doing was keeping the protests separate and small. So you might have 1,500, 2,000, 2,500 people in Grant Park, and then you might have another 1,000 people in Lincoln Park. They were able to, from their perspective, manage the protests so that you never really had one large protest gathering in a single space. And as these individuals were marching, the incredible group of police, they would march along with the protesters on the outside of the protest and they'd have bicycles, and they weren't riding the bicycles, they were walking their bicycles. So the bikes actually provided another barrier that, so I believe the strategy was, and I don't know this, but if something were to break out, the police would have been able to pick up the bicycles and use the bicycles as a defense weapon before they had to use any other type of force.
Wow, that's amazing. So they were determined, because everyone compares what they thought was going to happen in Chicago to the 68 convention, obviously.
Yes, yes.
And so obviously that was not going, from your perspective, that was not going to happen. They had learned the lessons of 68, in other words.
Well, I will say to a certain degree, no, because even though there was not any unrest, as I listened to the Chicago chief of police speak on television, the police, and I'll just use that as the general term for all the security forces, they brought a mentality into the event that the protesters were there in a destructive mode as opposed to a constructive mode. So I heard the chief of police talking about, we're not going to allow these people to come to our city and tear our city up. Well, that's not why they were there. Mm-hmm. But that was the mindset that the police brought into the event. And now, in the comparison of 68 and 2024, this is why I say that they didn't learn lessons. Because Hubert, I believe that Hubert Humphrey lost 68, not because of the protests that were taking place outside the convention center. The Democrats lost 68 because they didn't listen to the protesters that were outside in 68. And so as the Democrats and Vice President Harris are refusing to listen to the pro-Palestinian protesters now. And I believe that this could be a huge problem for them going forward, particularly as it relates to Michigan. And folks have to remember, this is an electoral college issue. You have to get to 270. And I don't see how they get there without Michigan. And mm-hmm. so this is not the general vote. This is 270. And they got to figure out how to get to 270 and sticking to this issue where they're not going to even recognize the Palestinians, I think is a huge mistake.
It's interesting because, as you probably know, they're actually having a fairly large national meeting in Michigan this week of the undecided. So they're mm-hmm. beginning to organize as undecideds.
Correct.
So there were a series of demonstrations outside the convention, such as the one you've been talking about, calling for a ceasefire, a U.S. ceasefire, or in Gaza, that received, I thought, minimal attention.
Correct.
From the press. Were you able to interview folks who were protesting or get a sense of how the official convention, you talked a little bit about that. For example, there was a call for a Palestinian to speak at
yes.
the convention. That
Correct.
Did not happen. So
Correct.
Can you sort of opine on that issue?
Yes, there were some uncommitted delegates, and because they were credentialed, they were able to get into the United Center, and they went outside and they had a sit-in on the grounds of the convention. And they were demanding that a pro-Palestinian speaker be allowed to speak, which only made sense to me since President Biden and Vice President Harris keep talking about democracy and they're defending democracy. And they're talking about, democracy but they seem to be very undemocratic in their platform and in selecting who was gonna be allowed to speak and who's not gonna be allowed to speak. And they're also talking about sovereignty. And so, you know, where's the sovereignty for the Palestinians? They allowed parents of captives to present from the stage. Why not allow a Palestinian spokesperson to speak as well? So that was an issue outside, But with the exception of myself, who was doing interviews and doing interviews outside of my responsibility with politicsandcolor.com, which, by the way, shameless plug, people can go and look at the coverage at politicsandcolor.com. I was one of the few voices inside the space saying, this is a huge mistake. This is undemocratic. Y'all need to let the Palestinian voice be heard. But most of the folks, they did not want any part of that conversation.
When you say most of the folks, you're talking about other delegates, you're talking about journalists,
talking about everybody in the United Center.
There was not a sense of urgency about letting.
And of course, I didn't speak to everybody in United Center. That's more of a euphemism. But the sense that I was able to glean from whether it was talk show hosts, whether it was delegates, whether it was just people that were there to support the ticket, nobody I spoke to, other than Dr. Cornel West, wanted to have that conversation.
That's interesting. Now, in addition to the Palestinian issue, there were other issues some were highlighted and some were diminished. From your perspective, which issues, outside of the Palestinian issue, were given prominence and in the convention, and why? And which issues, if you could just think of one or two, were intentionally diminished, and why?
Well, I think I can use three issues, and those three issues would answer your question each way. One is Palestine. And, as soon as Vice President Harris comes out and says, Israel has the right to defend itself. Well, first of all, in terms of international law, she's as wrong as the day is long, because international law has concluded years ago that oppressors do not have the right to claim self-defense against the oppressed, and the oppressed have the right to use any means at their disposal to resist that oppression. So that's the first point. Ukraine was another point. Talking about defending Ukraine when, in fact, it's the United States that started this fight. Russia and their military intervention, not an invasion, their military intervention, they are merely defending their borders against threats posed by NATO. So the alternative of that issue was not discussed. We could talk about China and the United States policy towards China as it relates to trying to pick a fight with China over Taiwan. What you heard from Vice President Harris was the Biden policy, which is imperialism and military expansion and the defense of American imperialism. That's what you heard coming from the dais from most of the speakers that were on the stage. I hope that answers your question.
But also on the domestic side, I'm interested in that one as well.
Okay.
It was interesting to me as an observer, for example, on the issue of police brutality.
Yes, I was going to get to that.
Please go ahead.
Well, when you listen to Vice President Harris's speech, she talks about defending the right to vote. She talks about the John Lewis Voting Rights Bill, and as that should be defended, as that should be passed. And then she starts talking about violence, and she starts going into this discussion about violence, and you then think she's going to mention the George Floyd Policing Act. But she doesn't. She starts talking about, I think, securing the border. Mm-hmm. And what gets omitted from securing the border as a domestic issue is, why are these people at the border in the first place? And most of these people are at the border, whether it be Haiti, whether it be Nicaragua, whether it be Colombia, whether it be Guatemala, because the United States foreign policy in those countries is wreaking havoc on the economies of those countries, leaving these people with no means of gainful employment, and so they have to seek employment elsewhere. And I'll give you a quick example for those listening that may want to wonder what I'm talking about. About 3 weeks ago, and folks, you can look this up, Chiquita Brands, the banana company, was convicted in U.S. federal court in Florida for sponsoring death squads in Colombia. And so now Chiquita Brands has to pay millions of dollars in restitution to the families of the victims that they were responsible for paying death squads for murdering Colombians. So if you have an American corporation sponsoring death squads in Colombia, and then you find a whole bunch of Colombians at your border, well, you got to figure out why they're there. They're not there because they have nothing else better to do. They're there because they can't find anything else better to do.
No, it's absolutely a perfect example of why people leave everything that they hold dear, family, homes, whatever it is, the place where their children go to school and seek, you know, another living situation. I loved your article on the dangers of binary politics for the African American community. It was in the Black Agenda Report, which I think is one of everyone knows. I think it's one of the best news agencies that I know of, certainly. And you say too many in the African American community appear to be more confused than ever. Mm-hmm. I'm quoting you. We have traded our interest in for electability and anybody but Trump, end quote. Former NAACP board chairman Julian Bond told us that we have no permanent friends and no permanent enemies, just permanent interests. Malcolm X called them permanent agendas. And, you know, I would also, if you don't mind, add another or maybe political formation onto that, and to talk. In the situation that we're in today, I would assume. So it seems that the Black community is confronted with this binary political dilemma. And we're faced with two parties that do not view the issues and crises confronting Black people as primary concerns that deserve what Dr. King called the fierce urgency of now. Mm-hmm. How do we break out of this? And we only have a few more minutes, but how do we break out of this binary configuration, political configuration in our community?
My editor tells me I shouldn't refer to it this way because it's demeaning, but I think it makes the point. Our politics has to mature, and we have to get beyond this Trump derangement syndrome. And I say all the time, I'm not advocating for any candidate. I'm not a political operative. I'm a political scientist. And so I'm trying to point out the realities that confront us. And so all I'm saying is, if you decide to vote for Kamala Harris, God bless you. If you think she represents your interests, you vote your interests. But understand what you're voting for and why you're voting for those interests. And I'm the piece, I wrote another piece, You're With Her, But Is She With You? Which is the question of what are we as a community, what are we as a political constituency demanding from our candidates? And if we aren't making any demands, as former President Barack Obama said when he was asked, well, why didn't you do more for Black Americans? Because y'all didn't demand nothing. Mm-hmm. So, the guy that owns one of those software platforms gave Vice President Harris $7 million. And when he did that, he went on national television and demanded that she remove the chairman of the Federal Trade Commission. Here's $7 million. Here's what I want for my money. So when the women got together and they got on the call and they raised $30 million and they gave $30 million to Kamala Harris and everybody is applauding that effort, that's wonderful. What are you going to get for your money in terms of policy output? Because to me, that's what's important.
Right, right, exactly. Yeah, and you know, and some people have obviously described, you know, Black politics as being, you know, more honorary in terms of people,
yes.
People feeling that people
symbolic.
Symbolic as opposed to substantive.
Correct.
And so I would just encourage everyone to look at your article. We've run out of time. I mean, I had so many more questions, but I just want to thank you so much for all of your hard work in our community.
Oh, thank you.
And I'm looking forward to having you on What's at Stake again. And also just, you know, as we go through the mm-hmm. election cycle, updating
sure.
and
sure.
trying to understand, you know, where do our interests lie and how do we make sure that we're taken seriously?
I tell people quickly, go to the Gary platform, go to the Gary convention from 1972. And the Gary Declaration is a great place to start.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Excellent. Well, thank you so much. And we look
My
forward
pleasure.
To talking to you again.
Looking forward to it.
Thank you. We
All
will
right.
take a short break for community announcements, and we will be right back.
This Labor Day, September 2nd, WPFW centers programming celebrating workers with The Grind, Work, Resistance, and Hip Hop. From 9 a.m. until 1 p.m., we'll hear from workers about conditions, organizing, and resistance, as well as present our annual survey of labor music. At 1 p.m., WPFW's Decipher Collective takes over until midnight, with hip-hop reflecting the highs, lows, and mid-ranges of the daily grind. That's The Grind, Work, Resistance, and Hip-Hop. This Labor Day, 9 a.m. until midnight, on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Good morning, and welcome back to What's at Stake. I'm your host, Dr. Marsha Coleman Adebayo, and I host What's at Stake, this segment of What's at Stake every fourth Wednesday of the month. Next, I am thrilled to announce on WPFW that the law firm of Holland & Knight, the 15th largest law firm in the country, filed a lawsuit against one of the largest developers in the United States for the desecration of Moses African Cemetery. In order to discuss this issue, we have assembled a small roundtable of community leaders who have fought to stop the desecration of this historic site. We're joined today by Dr. Segun Adebayo, pastor of the historic Macedonia Baptist Church, and Ari Gutman, senior community organizer for the Bethesda African Cemetery Coalition. It should be noted before we begin the discussion that the Maryland Supreme Court will issue its ruling on whether the community or the court must be informed and involved before a developer purchases a Black cemetery. This is going to be a historic decision by the Maryland Supreme Court. So I'm hoping that everyone will please stay tuned and please stay attentive to the upcoming decision. Let's talk to Ari. Good morning, Ari.
Good morning. Thanks for having us on.
Well, thank you so much for being on today. This is obviously a very exciting development that's been we've worked so hard.
I think.
To bring this issue to the attention of the American public. Can you provide from your perspective, background to the struggle for Moses Cemetery, but focusing really on the area where the lawsuit that's just been filed is concerned with, and that's the area of the cemetery that's right next to a McDonald's. Right, it's on River Road itself in Bethesda, Maryland. So could you please provide some background to this particular part of the cemetery?
Absolutely. So there's been some kind of questions or some kind of lack of understanding really for some time about what Moses Cemetery is, in part because it's been used and in use for over 200 years, right? And it's taken different shapes and forms based off how it was being used, what communities were using it. And so just very quickly, the portion of Moses that is currently being disputed in the Supreme Court of Maryland, or has a case in the Supreme Court of Maryland, is a part of the cemetery that is more formally referred to as a cemetery, right? It's you know, we know that people buried their ancestors there. There was more of a formal burial process that is more typically associated with modern African American burial grave sites. Now, the portion that is now going into a legal process is a portion of the cemetery that we often refer to as a burial ground. And the reason we refer to it as a burial ground is because the people who were, who are in this portion of Moses were dumped there by, European enslavers who, owned these people, had kidnapped these people and their families from Africa, and had forced them to, produce all of the labor on River Road. And it's not just these, people that were dumped in this in this portion of Moses. There are other people who were also interred in Moses, most likely more formal graves, but family graves. So during, historically, it doesn't happen so much anymore, though it still does sometimes. You will bury a family member in the back of your home. And we know that during there were family plots on this portion, and so we know, and it's in the legal process as well, in this lawsuit as well, that there were family burials here. But it was never, as the other portion of Moses, rows of graves, and you have the kind of more what we would today associate with the image of a cemetery. Now, a big part of this lawsuit, right, is getting the court to actually acknowledge, right, that people were buried here, that people were dumped here, whatever term you want to use. The point is that the developers are digging up people, right? That's what matters here, regardless of why they were put there, how they were put there, the formal process in which they were interred. No. Funerary objects, potential human remains. We even have a tombstone, right? That we have multiple images of. Those were dug up by the developer, and the county let them do it. The county gave them cover to do it in broad daylight. And the developers, knowing that they had been desecrating a burial ground, did it anyway, right? So there's an element of this that is negligence. That is this new lawsuit that has been filed. I think it was filed mid last week. So we're excited to kind of see where this process takes us. I hope that was, some good enough background.
Absolutely. And Reverend Adebayo, could you also add your perspective in terms of the background? And in particular, could you talk about the little girls on River Road who would have been unceremoniously dumped in this part of the cemetery, as well as the trafficking of human remains out of the cemetery to Virginia?
Well, I was going to also add the fact that some folks have disputed the burials took place in this parcel of land. And the fundamental question that we need to deal with is the fact that one is the fact that slavery occurred on River Road. Number two, there are so many so-called plantations up and down River Road. And so the question is, when those folks were, you know, worked to death, you know, where were they buried? And the simple fact is that they were buried in that parcel of land that used to be a swamp. There was no formal cemetery lined up with the headstones like you see in the modern cemetery, but those were where ancestors were dumped, including the fact that, you know, there was, you know, breeding on River Road, you know, where young girls, you know, were made to carry babies in order to fuel, you know, the pocket of those, you know, cruel enslavers. And so many of these little girls died in childbirth. And of course, they dumped their body in the swamp. And so that's what we've been fighting for this so many years that we've been involved in this struggle. It's a struggle and a fight for human dignity. And it's a struggle that we fight because the way our ancestors are regarded and treated, that's the way we are regarded and treated. So we'll continue to fight this struggle, and we are so, you know, thankful to the Love Farm for finally bringing us a place where our voices can be heard. Our voices have been ignored by the political leaders. And so now, you know, thank God for this Holland and Knight that is giving us this venue to be able to go and tell our story. And we look forward to telling our story.
Reverend Adebayo, I mean, you're the pastor of the historic Macedonia Baptist Church, which was at the center of this community. I mean, it was built by the hands of the people who built Montgomery County, built Washington, D.C., built, you know, the same people built the United States. And yet this church has been, you know, ignored in terms of the concerns about the cemetery. But you're not alone. I mean, throughout the United States, African burial grounds are being, you know, dug up. They're being discarded. They're being defiled. So why do you think this society has made, obviously, an intentional decision? Because it's structural. It's not just happening in one place. It's happening across the country, which means that there's some organization behind it. So why do you think there's this need to disregard the history and the significance of the people who are buried in these burial grounds across the United States?
I think, simply put, this is simply a continuation of our history as a people, not only in this country, but, you know, back on the continent, that unfortunately our so-called white counterparts, they have no regard for us. When you understand the history of this country, you remember that they regarded us as subhuman. They regarded us as not to be, you know, regarded as anything but, you know, property. So for so many centuries, this has continued. When you read the history of the 13th Amendment, the 14th Amendment, the 15th Amendment, and even what, you know, churches, you know, white churches, you know, back in the times of enslavement, you know, so-called ministers of the gospel described us as, you know, without souls. that we are not human. And so this is a continuation. So it's not restricted only to Bethesda and Maryland. It's across the country. But the sad part is that we as a people, we have abdicated a moral obligation to continue to fight for the dignity of our ancestors. Because if we don't fight for them, no one is going to fight for them. And so we have to come together as a people in this nation and to say, this is unacceptable. This is not going to happen on our watch, and fight to protect the dignity so that ancestors, having borne the brutality of the system under which they were consigned, that at least we can honor them in death and allow them to rest in peace. That is right. Our obligation as their descendants.
Right. Thank you. Ari, during the last segment with Dr. Leon, we discussed the Democratic Party convention and the issues that were ignored or intentionally diminished or highlighted. I'm wondering if you could connect these two issues, because he talked about interest groups like African Americans, like people who are concerned about human rights, you know, raising their concerns and raising them as demands upon the system. And I just wonder if you could also, you know, maybe bring this conversation together in terms of, you know, what are the common threads that we're looking at between these two issues?
Yeah, I think, you know, to Reverend's point and to tie into, you know, and I don't want to just say that it's the Democratic Party platform, because ultimately both parties are united in their attitudes against African people. This is, you know, the foundation of both parties is one of, you know, oppressing and essentially maintaining Black people as chattel, not only domestically, but also internationally. And neither party has really strayed from that original position, though, of course, the Democrats offer us a far more intersectional capitalism, where, you know, Black faces are able to be the face of an imperialist capitalist party. The Republicans have opted for a more white supremacist, patriarchal glaze, I guess I could say. I think what's important here to note about Maryland and our, you know, the cemetery, the location where the cemetery is, which is Bethesda, Maryland, in a county called Montgomery County, is that this is one of the wealthiest counties in the United States. It is also one of the most blue counties in the United States. So every single elected official that we have spoken to throughout our struggle has been a Democrat, right? We've gone national, spoken with Jamie Raskin. We've gone local, spoken with our county executive, Mark Elrich. We've also spoken with a majority of the members of the county council. All of them know who we are, know about the issue. Has a single one come out against Black cemetery desecration, even rhetorically, even in words? Not a single one. And even in private meetings that we've had with them, not recorded, we've guaranteed them complete, we've guaranteed nothing that comes out of your mouth in this meeting will be heard by the public. They will not in words say, we are against Black cemetery desecration as a moral and ethical failure of our society. They won't do it. And I think the fact of the matter is, there is money to be made off the bodies and the backs of Black people, right? And this is a system that necessitates, in one way or another, slavery. And so, you know, Black people in the United States, in the Americas more largely, have been, you know, chosen, have been forced to play this role, right? When capital is in crisis, or when capital needs to be made and money needs to be made, it is Black people who suffer the consequences. And we can also take, you know, the international angle of this, you know, AFRICOM and the US's policies towards Africa, because I do think what's very important for us to connect and acknowledge the fact that the people buried in Moses Cemetery are African people. They are not North Americans. They were never made Americans. They were kidnapped as Africans and forced to work as Africans. The United States has a policy towards Africa that continues to this day, which is, you know, constant bombing of Somalia, invasion of Libya, sanctioning of Zimbabwe and other countries in the region, which ultimately create crises for African people internationally and domestically. Because as we mentioned, you know, it's not just Colombians and Nicaraguans and Hondurans and Guatemalans that are coming to the United States. It is also Africans who are being forced to leave their homes and come to a society that treats them as second-class citizens. And so I hope that kind of ties in some of these issues, but I really do want to, you know, as we go into election season, it is important for people to think about who they're voting for. And just because someone is a Democrat does not mean that they are your friend or that they serve your interests.
And we don't have very much time left in this segment, but can you both, Reverend Adebayo and Ari, talk about the historic nature of where we're at right now? We're on the verge of a Maryland Supreme Court decision that was sponsored by BACC, Bethesda African Cemetery Coalition, which is going to impact this issue throughout the United States, and I would argue probably throughout the world. People will obviously take note of this. You know, we've been featured in Guardian and other international newspapers across the country. And also in terms of the second lawsuit now, that's focused, and we haven't really spoken about the bones that were trafficked. But you know, what is, we are, in, this is, these are lawsuits that are making history. Can you comment on that?
Well, yes, quickly, the reality of human life is that, you know, freedom has to be earned. Freedom has to be fought for. And so that's, you know, how we are continuing to make history. The liberty that, you know, we have today as Black people. Recently, I was, you know, at a museum in Detroit, the, you know, Dr. You know, Wright Museum of African American History. And when you look back to see where we came from, it's not because somebody gave it to us. We fought for it. And so that's part of the history that we are making. We must continue to fight, you know, for our freedom, you know, for our liberty, for us to demand our humanity, that we are no less than anyone. We don't claim to be better than anyone. And so for me, you know, where we are now is a very important place. And it simply shows that some of us are still continuing to fight to demand that we and a place not only in this society, but all over the world. Like Harry was saying, you know, the oppression of our people is not only limited to those of us who are here in North America, but also happens, you know, in so many countries in Africa where people have then to flee their homeland looking right. for a better place solely because of the policy, this country, in so many African countries. So that's where the history has been made, that we can continue to fight and struggle, and we know that we will get there someday.
And I think, right. and you know, Ari, mm-hmm.
go ahead, Ari.
Just specifically on the lawsuits. Specifically on the lawsuits. I think what's really important for people to understand here is, one, without the organization of BACC and without the continued advocacy of our community, we would not have been able to, you know, create these, you know, these lawsuits, because the amount of research and work that went into these legal documents is really, really remarkable. I mean, you have like 80 pages of just history entering the Maryland courts. And what one thing that happened with our Supreme Court case is that it was the courts who forced the county to acknowledge that they were lying to their community, right? The county was claiming, no, we're not desecrating. There's no burial ground. Rather, there's no cemetery here. And the court said, yes, there is. Now what comes next, right? And so what these court cases really give us is ammunition to continue our struggle, to make sure that our struggle is, you know, on this, we're all on the same page. Because unfortunately, what happens in this, you know, what happens often is that unless you have a lawyer or a judge say, you know, you're innocent or you're guilty or you're correct or this is true or this is false, a lot of people won't believe you, particularly when it's African people, you know, organizing around their rights. Fortunately, the courts have you know, believed us because we know that we're right. And so this new lawsuit essentially is going to be affirming, confirming a lot of the details that we know to be true, such as the fact that, you know, potential human remains, bone fragments were taken out of Moses, funerary objects were removed out of Moses and discarded illegally. All of these details that are very, very important will now be in court, and the court will decide whether or not they are true.
I just wanted to mention, not only are they important, but they're also illegal, and they should be. And they,
absolutely.
And the criminals should be prosecuted.
Absolutely.
In the same way that they prosecute little black boys for stealing bags of potato chips or whatever. How can the public get in contact with BACC and get involved?
Yeah, we have open meetings every single Thursday via Zoom, and we really, really encourage folks to come to those meetings. They're at 6 p.m. Eastern time. We do have folks calling in from all over the country. We also have some international folks as well. So we really do encourage folks to join us. Folks can check out, there's a join us, or rather a contact us page on our website, which is BethesdaAfricanCemetery.net. Folks can join, find us there. And also they can find us on all social media, just by looking up Bethesda African Cemetery Coalition. We're on TikTok now, we're on Twitter, we're on Instagram, we're on Facebook. And there's a link tree on all of our social media that has our website, our email, all kinds of ways to contact us. But we really, really encourage folks to join the struggle, join us every Thursday, and then stay kind of in the loop, because things are changing every day. It's a very dynamic struggle.
Right. Well, I want to thank both you and Pastor Adebayo for this incredible interview. I'd like to thank Dr. Wilmer Leon, again, Dr. Segun Adebayo, Reverend Adebayo, Ari Gutman. Thanks to executive producer Ms. Verna Avery Brown. The program is engineered by Mr. Michael Nasella. I am Marcia Carmen Adebayo. Thank you all for listening. We are celebrating the 22nd anniversary of the passage of the No Fear Act, the first civil rights and whistleblower law of the 21st century. WPFW salutes whistleblowers.
Hey, it's that time again. Join WPFW as we move to get fit at the annual 5K run walk for total fitness. Dynamic fitness instructors will be there, free healthy snacks and water, exciting music, boat rides for families, and a double dutch contest and a hand dance contest are all included in the 5K fundraiser. This event takes place at the Bladensburg Waterfront Park, 4601 Annapolis Road in Bladensburg, Maryland, from 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. on Saturday, September 14th. Now, for more details on how to register, visit our website, wpfw.org, or call 202-888-5484. That's 202-888-5484. Meet you at the park on Saturday, September 14th, 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. WPFW, making a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Dear beloved listening audience, thank you so much for your tremendous support.
Your unwavering dedication has taken WPFW over our goal despite a cyber attack. We are grateful for your generosity. It ensures that WPFW can continue to serve the people through our mission. If you missed the opportunity to pledge, you can visit WPFWFM.org to make a donation at any time. Together, we can build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Mumia Abu-Jamal reminds us that August is a month of repression, of radical resistance, of injustice and divine justice, of righteous rebellion, of individual and collective efforts to free the slaves and break the chains that bind us. On August 29th, from 1 until 7 p.m., through both public affairs and music, WPFW reflects on the origins of Black August and honors the lives and legacies of Jonathan and George Jackson and all Black freedom fighters as we recommit to the sovereignty and resilience of Black people around the world. That's Black August, Thursday, August 29th, 1 until 7 p.m. on WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time.
Black August, not February, nah. For every weary soul who had to bury those in the cemetery.
This Labor Day, September 2nd, WPFW centers programming celebrating workers with The Grind, Work, Resistance, and Hip Hop. From 9 a.m. until 1 p.m., we'll hear from workers about conditions, organizing, and resistance, as well as present our annual survey of labor music. At 1 p.m., WPFW's Decipher Collective takes over until midnight, with hip-hop reflecting the highs, lows, and mid-ranges of the daily grind. That's The Grind, Work, Resistance, and Hip-Hop. This Labor Day, 9 a.m. until midnight, on WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time.
The 20th anniversary of DC Jazz Fest happens August 28th through September 1st, featuring performances by Samara Joy, Jacob Collier, Stanley Clark, Emmett Cohen, Ron Carter, Diane Reeves, and more. Details at dcjazzfest.org. WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time.
Hi, this is Tom Cole, host of G-Strings, here on WPFW every Sunday morning. I and the rest of the station's volunteers and staff would like to invite you to join the WPFW Legacy Listener Circle by making a contribution to the station's future through your estate plan. There are a lot of ways to do that, through your IRA or retirement plan, by gifting us life insurance, or through your donor-advised fund. We'd be happy to have a confidential discussion with you as you consider a planned gift to the station. Please reach out to us at plannedgiving@wpfw.org or call us at 202-588-0999. Thank you for considering becoming a part of WPFW's future.
School is back. Do you need an after-school program for your young one? The Words Beats and Life Academy is enrolling for students from third grade up to young adults, with programming weekdays, 3:30 to 6 p.m., offering classes in hip-hop performing and visual arts, as well as business and arts leadership, with access to professional teaching artists, equipment, and resources. Located in Columbia Heights, Northwest Washington, D.C. at St. Stephen's Church. Classes are always free. Enrollment at wblinc.org/academy, based on availability. The fall session begins September 9th. We hope to see you or your young one there at the Words, Beats, and Life After School Academy.
All right, all right.
Remember, wblinc.org/academy.
Hey, Chris Garlock here.
And I'm Elise Bryant.
Tune in Thursdays at 1 p.m.
for the Labor Heritage Hour Hour.
Every week, we explore labor arts and culture.
As anarchist Emma Goldman said so famously, If I can't dance, I don't want to be part of your revolution.
And that's how we feel about labor music, films,
theater, poetry,
labor history, labor art,
spoken word, basically anything that brings labor and the arts together.
So, join us for the Labor Heritage Power Hour
here on WPFW 89.3 FM.
Your station for jazz and justice.
That's the Labor Heritage